It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
In 2020, events have yet again shone a light on racial inequalities across the globe. Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
I mean,
these comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
But I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy. Very good.
Hello and thanks for joining Democracy Sausage, the only podcast with the central mission of bringing together the best scholars and commentators from the capital and beyond twice a week. I'm Mark Kenny from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute and the School of Politics and International Relations. The situation in Melbourne seems to be stabilising, with the daily rate of new infections holding steady at below 400, even if the crisis is far from over, especially in aged care homes where the response has been shamefully inept. And stubbornly so. A new record has been set today for deaths, most of them in these beleaguered facilities. Next week, federal MPs and senators will gather in Canberra, where many questions will be asked on that subject, and who knows, some might even be answered. But don't hold your breath. The reason it's called question time is because, for the most part, that's all you get, questions. Luckily, my panel this week is not so jaded. Well, let's see. Professor Helen Sullivan is director of the Crawford School of Public Policy, which generously supports this podcast, and her research explores changing state-society relationships as well as new forms of democratic participation. Helen, there's plenty of grist for your mill in these challenging times, deficient policy, failures of public administration, right at a time when public trust had rebounded, when it seemed to be growing. Do you think the botched hotel quarantine and nursing home debacles will send trust back the other way again quite smartly?
Yes, I do. I think that certainly the way in which it's being played out in the media and the fact that having got their teeth into this issue, the media keep asking, quite rightly, questions about it, I think will filter into the public consciousness and will start a reversal in what was already, you know, just a slight trend. I mean, we know that for years public trust has been declining. So, not surprising that it's gone up a little bit given the government's response. But I think, yes, it will go back down.
Yeah, because like people, it seems like all around the world, except for those countries where they've, you know, really egregiously botched it, like the US and Brazil, and even the UK to a lesser extent, perhaps. But in most places, there has been a tendency to get behind the government. That's because the populations in each of those countries actually needs the government to succeed, just like we need the Morrison government to succeed here and the various state governments. So I suppose it's not all that surprising that we've seen a dialing down, as I've described it before, of politics and an emphasis on problem solving and having governments do things, and that what's come with that has been this higher level of public support. So leaders have become more popular. They've certainly become more prominent because they're doing things like daily press conferences. We need them to all be sort of rowing in the same direction. There's been a bit of that, of course. So all of those things have added to this sort of uptick in confidence and trust in the focus of our governments. But we're now seeing the result of mistakes, and we're seeing politics come into the responses about that.
Absolutely. And politics is never far away, and indeed, nor should it be. I think there's a little bit of a myth that somehow, decisions are better made if politics isn't involved. Well, everything is political. And so it's naive to think that politics wouldn't come into play. I think what's been revealing, though, is the degree to which, while there has been, as you say, a sense of public support getting behind the government, you know, the idea of the national cabinet, which seems to have worked reasonably well, at the same time, I think people are still wondering about, in as much as they have time to, what's going to happen in the longer term. And the extent to which anything that's happening now is going to lead to long-term change, I think, is a fundamental question, and one which I'm not seeing much sign of. What I'm seeing is a sign of people wanting to return to business as usual, however they define that. And certainly in politics, it seems to be very much that kind of factionalized and entirely adversarial politics. Now, that's important when you have questions, as you say, that need to be asked and also need to be answered. That's really important that we have a strong sense of accountability. And I think that's the thing that's missing and has been, it's been going missing for a while. But certainly that's the thing that's been held up, I think, in sharp relief through the pandemic, is the extent to which there has been an erosion of accountability. And whether or not people front up to daily media briefings, which is absolutely right. I think around that, there are still too many instances where questions should be asked, are being asked, but they're not being answered. And that, I think, will contribute to a further decline in public trust. And I think that's dangerous.
It's a really tricky area, though, isn't it? Because if you're in opposition, you need to measure the extent to which you second guess or critique government policy. There's there's this sort of overwhelming sense that we need to be all on the same page in terms of the effort. So oppositions aren't going to be trying to tear down governments through this crisis, and there's nothing in it for them in doing so. But at the same time, there's a whole lot of authority extended to governments through this process, and officials and police and other authorities, right at a time when accountability is kind of wound back, partly because of this unanimity of purpose. So there's a shelf life to this kind of process before you have to really get that accountability back.
Oh, you're right, of course. But I would say that in a way, it's all the more important that accountability doesn't take a step back. You can be in opposition and at the same time support the idea that, you know, we are all in this together, which, of course, we aren't. You can do, you know, both of those things at the same time. And I think it's not been as evident as it should be in many parts of the world. And I think that then becomes, as many things do, habitual. And so we just get used to the fact that the government refuses to participate in public inquiries or refuses to send its public servants to public inquiries because it doesn't want them to be besmirched, which I think was how Peter Dutton put it. So, you know, these things very quickly become just the norm. And so it's vitally important that people are held to account, because remember, yes, political parties have a job to do, but their fundamental job is to represent the people. And I think that's the thing that's got lost. And there is a really worrying trend, it seems to me, which is also evident in Australia. I mean, Australia is not exempt, as much as it likes to think it is sometimes. There is a very worrying trend of the public just thinking that actually politics is not for them, it's not about them, and it doesn't really matter what happens, they don't benefit. And the consequences of the global financial crisis, for example, who was held accountable for that? One person in the States went to prison. The banks got bailed out. You know, so if you are, an ordinary working person, whoever they are, then you can look at this and think, you know, where did my government go? What is politics? It's not for me. And that you know, then leads us into all sorts of worrying avenues towards populism and so on.
And but, very deep questions about what is the relationship between the government and the people, or and with the ratio of power, I suppose, between markets and governments. Mm. So these are quite fundamental questions that have been in flux and highly politicized for decades now. And this virus, this crisis has really brought a lot of that into sharp relief. It's the state that's had to step in to rescue the market. Mm. Admittedly, the state has been instrumental in tamping down the market as well, telling the economy, you know, you basically have to switch off. But people are suddenly relying on government to keep them going, as we know.
Yes, and also realizing that a number of the policy positions that we've held for 30, 35 years are not as secure and solid as we thought they were. And we're seeing that being, you know, the evidence of that is all around us, particularly in the dreadful situation in aged care homes, but also in the in what started all of this in Victoria, you know, the process of contracting out in the hotel quarantine program. So, you know, we all knew, those of us who study this, that, you know, the way in which governments entered into to contract, the way in which they tried to create and sustain markets had downsides, and there were some really obvious downsides. But for whatever reason, we as publics decided that we were going to live with that, and we are now living with the consequences of that.
Indeed, we are. Another of our guests from the Crawford School of Public Policy is Professor Sharon Bessel. Last year, Sharon was named as one of the Australian Financial Review's Women of Influence. She's the Director of Gender Equity and Diversity at the Crawford School. Welcome, Sharon.
Hi, Mark. It's good to be here.
And in fact, I should say welcome back, right, because you've been on Democracy Sausage before. The points that Helen was just making about some of the effects of this crisis, I mean, one of them that is spoken about a lot, but we don't see much done about it, is the disproportionate effect on women in the economy. And what this crisis has exposed is the extent to which women don't have the grip on economic security that men do as a cohort through through the economy. How are you seeing that?
Look, I think if there is one thing that this crisis has revealed, as have previous crises, is the greater precarity of women in the workforce. We see, you know, we have known for decades about not just the gender wage gap in Australia and globally, but also about the precarious nature of women's work, that women's work is more likely to be casualised or part-time. And so we're seeing the impacts of that as those kinds of jobs are the first to go. But the other thing, of course, that we've seen demonstrated very dramatically in this crisis is the double burden that women carry. And when we've seen lockdown occurring, when we've seen children not being able to go to school and other kinds of caring necessary, it's women that are primarily stepping into that role. And so I think we're seeing, you know, in very stark relief, the gender imbalance and the gender injustice that characterises our society and characterises labour markets, but also characterises the nature of unpaid work. And we also see those issues extending out into the nature of the caring professions. So the, you know, if we look at aged care, you know, many of the workers that are at the front line of aged care are women who are working often in contract arrangements, in precarious work for very low wages. And so we can connect all of these things together to start to see the way in which those kinds of structures of inequity and discrimination kind of play out and impact in so many different ways. So I think we are seeing, you know, the gendered dimensions of our society playing out really painfully through this pandemic, but also seeing the way in which that impacts right across the board.
Yes, well, we'll get into some of those issues a bit in later discussion, because the next stage, of course, is to see whether recognition leads to action, whether recognition of the problem, or, you know, greater exposure of the problem can be instrumental in driving any sort of change. It's another welcome back also to Megan Fitzharris, who these days is Senior Fellow in Health Policy and Leadership at ANU's College of Health and Medicine. And of course, Megan is a former Health and Transport Minister in the ACT government, a long-standing Labor government that will be facing the people in October this year. Megan, Do you feel any tinge of regret or fear of missing out, of not being involved, having changed careers, now joined the academy? But is there a sense, I mean, you know, MPs I talk to have often told me about elected office being something that gets in your blood. And a lot of MPs actually tell you, I don't know how many people believe this or how literally we should take it, but MPs have told me, ministers and others for years, that they like door knocking, they like campaigning. Yeah. Tell us, take us into your confidence here. are you glad you're not facing election, or is there a part of you that feels a bit of loss?
There is a part, yeah. Morning, Mark and Helen and Sharon. Certainly, I mean, it's one of three state elections coming up, Northern Territory this weekend, followed by the ACT and then by Queensland. And I certainly think
All Labor governments.
And I don't share Helen's gloominess. And certainly because I have been that person knocking on doors, standing at street stalls, and I do hope to join some of my colleagues who former colleagues who continue to do that. And you do have a deep connection with your local community, particularly if you are in the equivalent of a lower house seat, which is really all that the ACT does have. You do represent your community, but your community is rich. It's diverse. It's made up of people with multitude of different views. So you have a really important role in working with your community, representing their views, finding out what's going on, how changes in government policy impact on them, and what sorts of changes they would like to see. And I think for the state and territory level governments, that is why trust in that level of government is always higher than in the federal government. It's a little bit closer. The services are those delivered to the community every day. And I think we've seen that, you know, play out particularly across Australia, where you see premiers in particular have had extremely, you know, robust support from their communities. It's certainly a tough time to be in opposition, to be able to find the sweet spot. I also view your accountability is very real when you are talking to people whose decisions the decisions that you make in government, particularly being in the executive, make a difference. I think the view that there is lack of trust in government and everything is about politics probably needs to be picked apart a little bit. I think there is an element of politics that is not only participated in by politicians. I think what you saw was the collective, I guess, political economy of representative government looking different from all the actors, from the media, from stakeholder groups, from representative groups. People were really united, and that's not often the case because ultimately decisions that governments make and that parliaments consider are contestable. And so I think to assume that there's a contestable nature of the public policy process and the parliamentary process that isn't contestable is incorrect. But there is a lot that we can do to break that down and understand within that what is politics, you know, what is executive decision making. And that's around working with large bureaucracies and getting advice from alternate sources and weighing up and making executive decisions, which have an element of politics, but they're not entirely informed by the political process. So I'm less gloomy, and I'd like to think that there is room for optimism and how you know, MPs and politicians across the board connect with their communities about how decisions are made within organisations, particularly interested in seeing what happens with federalism. And I certainly know as a former health minister, the major issues that health ministers across the board, particularly at a state and territory level, would talk about were the interface issues with the primary care sector, the aged care sector, the disability sector, the social services sector immediately, and then broader sectors. Those have been exposed. And I think that the answers to those questions also lie in thinking about federalism and what role a national cabinet and its sort of constituent parts play once we get through this initial phase. So I remain an optimist.
Well, that's good. A bit of optimism is a good thing, and we need all of the optimism we can reasonably get hold of at this time. Let's just stick for a moment, though, with this delineation between perhaps a national government and state or territory governments, because I think a lot of people probably don't think about this in these terms, but people who've done politics and been involved in the bureaucracies of those levels of government do understand this, and that is that the federal government doesn't really do service delivery except in a few sort of specific areas, one of them being aged care, which it's doing so fabulously well at the moment.
Well, it doesn't deliver services per se.
It doesn't deliver services. No. And even in aged care, it doesn't deliver services. Yeah. It funds and regulates that service, but it's underfunded and it's poorly regulated. I think we can say that. Yes. And the evidence is overwhelming at the moment and tragically so. But it's been a long-term problem, which is why there was a Royal Commission going on into the aged care sector before the COVID crisis even occurred. But the areas that states get involved in, some of those that you listed off, you know, the running of hospitals, education, public transport, urban roads, police, you know, these are critical interface areas. And so I remember a friend of mine many years ago when he was going into politics, I asked him why he wasn't going into federal politics, because I guess that was my main interest. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, and I think it was quite laudable, and he went on to be a minister, he said, because the states are where you deliver the services that matter to people. And at that stage, I was quite young, but I hadn't really thought of it in those terms. So I think that there's a very honourable calling there to do it well, but you also see state governments crash on the basis of the failure of things, you know, particularly in public transport and projects that haven't been delivered that have run over time and over budget and these sort of things.
Yeah. I mean, certainly I would say on aged care, a number of almost all, and not in the ACT, but a number of jurisdictions actually, the state public sector will operate aged care facilities as well. And I think you're seeing in terms of where some of them are doing much better than the private and not-for-profit sector aged care facilities as well. So, look, I think that's right. There's a nuance there in that the Commonwealth doesn't deliver anything, but certainly it's the case that the state and territory systems will often pick up the pieces of where there has been failure, and public hospitals are probably the prime example of that, particularly for residents of aged care facilities, where they potentially can spend weeks and months, as well as people living with a disability can spend months and months in hospital because they don't have appropriate accommodation or they don't have the appropriate level of care to go back to in a residential aged care facility or in a... But there are some wonderful examples around the country of where there is now really good evidence to support how hospitals and the state system can inreach into residential aged care. The question is always at the national policy setting level around cost shifting. You move into that area, what does that mean for the cost shift? Who's picking up the tab? There are some real issues in there, but they can be picked apart.
And where does the line of accountability or responsibility go as well?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, there are a lot of figures that are reported in the annual report on government services that comes out that really go to a couple of those critical issues. And that would be a good place to start, particularly between the aged care sector and the state-run public hospital system. That would be a really good place to start to see innovation, where you're ultimately providing better care to the community from the collective taxpayer funded services that go into both of those sectors.
Now, Helen, you said in your opening remarks, you made an observation about not seeing much evidence of change, that there's sort of talk about it, that we're in this crisis. Some people think it changes everything. Where's your scepticism come from?
Evidence.
Yeah. Oh, that old thing, evidence. I guess what I was thinking, though, is that it's kind of unique, this circumstance we're in. Yes, experience counts, but this is a pandemic crisis that none of us have experienced before, and it has extraordinary characteristics that we're all living with. There is quite a debate about whether the world will be fundamentally changed, whether our economy and society will be fundamentally changed after this, or whether it won't. Some of those things are kind of predictable. I think, as you say, you can sort of see at least the beginnings of some evidence here in terms of the way businesses, companies will reorganize. Where's your skepticism come from, though? I mean, is it possible that we wouldn't be able to see from inside the, you know, from the eye of the storm, what the longer term effects of this are going to be?
Where does my skepticism come from? Well, I think it comes from the fact that, you know, this may be a unique experience, but we were warned about it.
Mm.
You know, we were warned that the next thing that would happen, the next big thing that was likely to happen would be a pandemic. And, you know, this wasn't warnings by people who, you know, have no authority. You know, Barack Obama talked about this years ago, you know, that this was what we should be prepared for. And I think so my skepticism comes from the fact that we have an awareness of this, and yet we've chosen not to act to prepare. And that goes to a broader point. And I, you know, I'm not wild about this kind of optimism, pessimism dynamic that's been set up. I don't think I am a pessimist. I think I'm a realist. And my skepticism comes from the fact that, you know, all governments, state, federal, whatever, have made decisions that they're not going to invest in the long term, that we don't think as a public long term. We think about now and we think about, you know, a few years hence, maybe.
The electoral cycle, for example.
The electoral cycle, for example. I mean, the public's probably less concerned about that than the politicians, but certainly it's exercised politicians for a good long while. And so, you know, there has been almost an unspoken agreement that what we focus on is what's going to get us through the next election. Absolutely, because, you know, that's where you win power. That's where you get to do what you want to do. But there has been an absolute reluctance to invest in the kinds of policy making, the kinds of intelligence gathering that we really need to be able to understand and prepare for a pandemic. And so my skepticism comes from the fact that we've known about this and we haven't acted. Now you could say we're in the eye of the storm, all bets are off, it could be different. Absolutely, it could be. Are we seeing any signs that it is, though? Are we seeing any signs that people are responding in ways other than the very important deal with the disaster as it's unfolding? You know, the thing about crisis is that it's both about doing what you need to do now, but also having an eye to how are we going to come out of this? And I don't see much sign that, in as much as people are preparing, and I know that they are because people from Crawford are involved in helping government do this, but I don't see much sign that we're thinking about doing things dramatically differently from the way in which we did in the past. We're just hoping that somehow normal will be restored, and I don't think it will be.
Mm, it's a very interesting point. Let's take a quick break there and come back and take up that discussion a bit further.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
All right, welcome back. Now, Sharon Bessel, Helen Sullivan was saying just before the break, asking the question, why are we not seeing any signs of this kind of readjustment? Now, what's your view about that? Is it possible that, for example, Parliament's not meeting, the economy has been in a state of suspended animation almost deliberately, and that's also been true of our political institutions. So Can we draw too much from that? I mean, or is it possible that as we come out of this, there will be a new recognition, there will be a re-energized public debate? Maybe I'm just being optimistic here. I think I am. I mean, I can feel it.
I think optimism is probably a good thing, perhaps equal doses of optimism and realism. I think we do have, or coming into this, when we saw lockdown happening and almost this global pause in society, it seemed as though there was the potential for us to really rethink what matters in societies, in communities, in families, to people's lives. I'm not sure we are taking advantage of that opportunity. And in some ways that's understandable because people are in crisis at the moment and governments are responding to that crisis. But I do think we need to focus some serious attention on what we actually want a society to look like. Because whatever happens coming out of this, it's not going to happen organically. It will be driven by a range of interests. And so it's fundamentally important that we think what interests we want to be driving that agenda and what we want a society to look like. And amidst all the crisis that we're seeing, I think one of the things that is emerging is the importance of care and an ethic of care and what happens when an ethic of care is lost in a society. And I think we see that in aged care. Mm. There's a crisis at the moment in terms of what's happening to people now during the time of pandemic. But as you said, Mark, that crisis is much deeper than that. We hear people who are in aged care facilities saying that it's not their home, it's the place they live until they die, and that they wake up in the morning thinking, as one woman recently said, damn, I survived the night.
Yeah.
Now, this is a really shocking indictment on society. I've done a lot of work with children in the out-of-home care system who also feel completely alone and isolated and abandoned often, unless they're lucky enough to fall into a really caring foster family. But for many of those children, the system has entirely failed them. And so we see this again and again where we have institutionalised care and then, to my mind, worse, we've privatised it. And once we start to privatise, we start to put profit around care. And so I think at this moment, we really need to think about what an ethic of care looks like in a society. And that cannot be shifting back to a 1950s model where we privatise care again back into the family and say women look after it. We need to really rethink what care looks like. And we need to think differently about the labour market so that all of people's time isn't consumed in creating an income so that they have no scope to care for one another, to care for their families, for the age, for children, for their community. So I think we need a fundamental rethinking, but that rethinking needs leadership.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. The idea that we've got institutionalisation and privatisation, I wonder, do you think the characteristics of this debate, leaving aside the whole neoliberal trend over recent decades in politics to privatisation and market logic and so forth, is part of this also a critical part, a sort of a genetic part almost of the faults that are in the system at the moment? The fact that care has traditionally been women's work and traditionally been unpaid. And therefore, to the extent that it's been incorporated into the economy, it's been incorporated in from a very disadvantaged position economically.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it's not just that it's women's work and it's less paid. It's also less valued, you know, less valued economically, but has also been somehow marginalised in terms of the value to the community. Even though I think, you know, innately we know how important that care is, both economic and social value hasn't been placed on it. And you said, Mark, you know, let's leave aside a neoliberal agenda for a moment. I don't think we can, because I think that neoliberal paradigm has been absolutely fundamental to that undervaluing. And so I think that's what we have to very explicitly think about and challenge. But we do also need to think about women's roles in this and what a feminist agenda would look like. If we think about these things through a lens of feminism, that is about genuine equity and equal outcomes, so that women are not carrying all of the burden for care, but so that men also have the opportunity to care. Now, I think we've kind of lost some of these really fundamental principles that we need to reclaim, if indeed they were ever there, because we do have an opportunity at the moment when we're seeing the impact of this crisis on people's lives and on their health and on their dignity to really say, what do we value in a society and who should carry responsibility for that? And that can't be only women. It has to be women and men, but it has to be governments. And a market has to serve that rather than driving an agenda that's around profit rather than care.
It's also about values, though, and unconscious bias, I think, in policy making that's been around for a long time. And we of course, all know of Tony Abbott's 19-member cabinet had one woman in it, and things have improved up and down a bit since then, but we've got nowhere near kind of 50% of a cabinet. I noticed the construction industry has its hand out for a $5.1 billion government stimulus program in that sector. That those are the sorts of areas that governments have traditionally regarded as real jobs. This is a point Richard Dennis from the Australia Institute has been making, you know, with some of his research, that if you put money into childcare to make childcare more accessible and better paid, it would lead to much better economic outcomes than, you know, this old paradigm of infrastructure, you know, being the only real thing that, you know, you have to build something to have a real job.
I think you could say that aged care, childcare, disability care is shovel ready. I mean, that's the phrase that they use for infrastructure projects.
And well, they've been treating aged care like they are shovel ready. I mean, that's the problem.
Yeah,
I mean, it's horrible thought. But you're right. I mean, you could group those three things together and say they are areas where they literally exist on the kind of periphery of budgetary consideration, and it's reflected in the incomes of people who work in there. And one of the problems we've seen with this COVID crisis as the coronavirus has ripped through the aged care sector is the problem of a lot of aged care workers working in multiple institutions on minimum wage or on something not far away from it, because they need to cobble together an income. And of course, then they become vectors for infection at more than one facility. And this is quite common.
But I think what we see here too is certainly the reliance on women as an underpaid, undervalued workforce. And we also see a kind of a social undervaluing of people who are not seen to contribute. So older people, young children, people with a disability who are not seen as contributing to the economy are seen as being worthy only of being put out of sight, you know, into an institution where they're cared for by people who themselves are undervalued and underpaid. And I think that's what I mean when I talk about an ethic of care, that we need to rethink how we value human beings within our society. And this isn't a tweaking around the edges. This is about fundamentally rethinking the principles that we value in our society and then the kinds of processes that we put in place to make that happen. But, you know, thinking about cost sharing between states and so on is not going to get us to that fundamental shift that we need. You know, we need a much deeper consideration of what kind of society we want to see in the future. And if we decide that we want to see a society in the future where those people who are unproductive can be institutionalized, given poor care, and allowed to die or live without dignity, then I think we've got a much bigger problem than a pandemic on our hands.
Yes. Megan Fitzharris, you understand politics in the kind of as a practitioner in your former role. Is this a critical moment? Both Helen and Sharon have been making the point about where we are in this crisis and the need for recognition of change and opportunity and doing something. In a sense, there's a kind of a blank page to be written on here, and interests, as Sharon made the point before, powerful interests will seek to shape that post-COVID agenda very, very strongly. So there's an invitation there. How urgent is it that these other interests, the interests of carers, the interests of greater female participation in the economy, how critical is it that they organise and move quickly now to have that voice heard?
I think it's very urgent. There are certainly movements and people having discussions about what we want our society to look like, and that is a conversation that happens every day in a multitude of different ways. I think the question then becomes, well, How do we decide that, and what are the mechanisms and the structures for that intent and that willingness to actually be enacted? I certainly, at the moment, I'm chairing a group in Queensland for the Queensland government on
remotely,
which we can do, and we have a number of people from Queensland and myself and someone based in Melbourne, but the But behind that is what has changed in the health system. What has been good? What should we continue to do? What should we no longer do? And how can we harness this incredible opportunity? So that governments are thinking ahead in a variety of different ways. I mean, certainly here in the ACT, investing in our significant investment in renewable energy, leading the country, our investment in light rail, and governments around the country have been looking beyond and taking serious political risks at an election cycle for projects that do go over the longer term. So, but like I say, Queensland at the moment is actually looking at what do we do in our health system? How can we take some of these benefits? I think a critical aspect of that has been looking at inequity, looking at the existing inequities, which you can see through health outcomes for particular groups, but particularly for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. There are real opportunities coming out of this to reshift some of that. And that's a very, I guess, practical level,
practitioner level. That's going to involve governments actually looking at themselves differently and suddenly realizing, yeah, hey, we actually have a material responsibility here to do something rather than just to put out some pamphlets and say some nice things.
Well, in the context of Queensland, the government's commissioned this significant piece of work to do yeah, exactly that.
Yeah, well, and commissioning work. I'm not poo-pooing that, but it's up to them to
consider what the recommendations are and
it would
and
be
to
good.
Act on them.
It would be fantastic, for example, to see governments around the country looking at social housing, which they could easily be doing as a very, you know, profoundly effective economic generator, whilst also achieving significant public good. And yet we don't really see much movement from it. We certainly haven't seen much movement on that front from the Commonwealth.
No, but here in the ACT, the government announced, I think just last week, the construction of new social and public housing and other ways of looking
but
for more affordable housing.
But it needs to be
housing.
Big. Yeah. I mean, it really does need to be big. You know, this sort of Green New Deal time. It's kind of time to look at big imaginative nation-transforming projects. The scope is there. The appetite is there. The need is there. But I don't know if the imagination is there. The courage, politically speaking.
Well, the courage certainly isn't there. And I think one of the challenges is, you know, all of the things that you've identified. And, you know, Megan's right in that, you know, people understand and experience government through the services that they receive. And so very often the local experience is really important. It can be great. It can be terrible. I spent a lot of time in Canberra hospitals last year and, you know, I had fabulous experience and I had dreadful experience. So there's something, but that is a very, you know, you're very proximate to the person who's delivering the service. So that's absolutely right. But of course, none of these things exist in and of themselves in a vacuum. You know, Australia, for all that, you know, it's a continent and it has borders. You know, everything that we do in terms of trade, defence, foreign relationships, care, all of that is now part of a global system. Now, while that global system has come to a bit of a shuddering halt, there is no question that, you know, if you're thinking about aged care or childcare, you know, who owns and delivers and operates those major corporations now, you know, are often people who are not based in Australia. Or if they are based in Australia, they actually run a global company. Mm. And so, you know, we need to understand that we're not just trying to reimagine how things might be for ourselves, which is fundamentally important and incredibly difficult. But it also requires us then adjusting those relationships that we have within the region and also as part of the global system, and trying to figure out which of those are things that we want to preserve and refine and enhance, and which of those are things that have not served us well and we do need to change. And I think this is where there is a real challenge, because we are all interconnected, you know, and we've become so used to being interconnected. But we now need to try and reimagine how we might retain the best of that while also mitigating the very worst, which is what Sharon's been talking about.
Yeah, Sharon, the PM recently at the press club talked about applying the "does it make the boat go faster" test. Now, this was a sort of a yacht racing term that came from an older campaign to win the America's Cup. And the chief designer had said whenever any sort of suggestion was made about upgrading the facilities or whatever else was happening, he said, "Yeah, but does it make the boat go faster?" And the PM was using this as a as a way of saying how focused he was on driving Australia's economic recovery and on you know, it's all about things that make the economy work better. And if it doesn't, I don't want to hear about it right now. Now, it's the kind of, you know, thing politicians like to say, I suppose, but it's also quite agreeable in a sense. We like to see, you know, absolute focus on that task. Why is it though that, and I guess we go, I'm going back to something I said a minute ago, but why is it though that women are not included in that? You know, there's an obvious economic case for improving the utilization of women in the economy. They are underutilized in terms of a labor resource. They are underpaid. Therefore, they underspend. Their participation in the economy could drive much greater productivity. There have been numerous research studies that have shown that over the years. Where's the impasse? Why can't governments actually start to make this change?
Well, I think part of it is around the values and the attitudes and the ideologies of particular governments and what they see as important and what they just have a blind spot on, what they miss. And I'm not sure that if we look around the world, all governments make this same mistake in terms of the involvement or the exclusion of women from the economy and from the labour market particularly. I think about that comment of making the boat go faster. I mean, I think that's a really worrying way of looking at it. Should we be making the boat go faster? Should we be making the boat more stable? No, there are different ways of thinking about this.
I think it was a yacht racing term, and I think the whole point of the yacht race was to win the race. But
although
so
not
you don't want to take it too literally.
Might be important too. but if we just focus on economic growth, then it does tend to put us on a particular trajectory. And to the extent that we will think about women within that, we think about getting women into the labour market. Now, that's not unimportant. You know, women's economic empowerment is fundamentally important. Mm. And women will then contribute to the economy. But is that the only prism that we should be thinking about this through? You know, is it just about economic growth? And if we look at other countries around the world, you know, we see countries starting to move towards the idea of a well-being economy and thinking quite differently, where economic growth is not unimportant, but economic growth becomes a means to a society that is based around greater well-being, but also based around greater gender equality and greater inclusion. So I think as long as we're stuck in this lens of economic growth is what it's all about, and we bring people into that only because they'll fuel it, then we're going to see gender-based discrimination and inequality continue. You know, we need a fundamental rethinking so that women have an equal role within society, make an equal contribution, but it's not in this really instrumentalist way of it's only about economic growth. You know, it has to be about more than that.
But even the gender pay gap can be seen as a handbrake on wage growth. Can it not? I mean,
absolutely.
If it's a significant part of the labour market, if women are being paid less, if they're earning less, generally speaking, then in a macroeconomic sense, there's this negative factor on wages growth. And wages growth is such a critical aspect of national growth. We know that governments have been trying to find ways, or they say they have been trying to find ways to drive wages growth and get that kind of demand going in the economy. And that is now, of course, a prime objective coming out of this to try and, you know, get some effervescence back into the economy. Here's a way of doing it. And yet what have we seen? We've seen policies like allowing people to access their superannuation. The figures are staggering on this policy. It's something in the order of $30 billion has been taken out of superannuation accounts by people in extremists at the moment. A lot of those are women. And, of course, we know women, they live longer and so they have a higher need for retirement savings, and yet disproportionately high number of women have now reduced their superannuation accounts, Megan, to nothing again, you know, and that's just going to exacerbate the problem.
I mean, pick up on Sharon's point about well-being and again, the notion that we want to see something different. I guess my experience and my professional life has been spent in, well, if we'd like to see that, how do we get that done? What are the things, one, that governments can say? What is the direction they can set? What is the role modelling they can give to that? And then how do you actually design, you know, a new reformed system to actually deliver key components of that? And that is really, really difficult. But it's also incredibly challenging, and why public policy is such a, you know, a fascinating field. And certainly if you look at the way, for example, New Zealand has reshaped their budget through a wellbeing lens, it is a fundamental overhaul and recasting of how you go about even your annual budget process within government, which is a significant exercise every year that governments go through. You value things differently.
Yeah.
You co-design with a wider range of people. So you have those voices around the table.
And if people think that's just tokenism, governments have been doing this in a whole range of other areas. Anyone who's worked on a cabinet submission knows that there are a whole range of headings that you have to put in the submission and answer.
Bottom line, or it could be,
So you have to answer about the environmental impact and the budget impact and labor resource impacts and a whole range of other impacts. All of those tests have to be met before that submission makes its way into cabinet. So the principle is entirely
orthodox. It becomes a bit of
orthodox.
A tick and flick sort of exercise.
It can do.
But an overhaul of your of the way that you think about well-being, and an overhaul of what is actually going to make a difference over a longer period of time. And I mean, I certainly think, I mean, the New Zealand experience over the last 3 or 4 years is fascinating, but you know, the combination of, you know, personal leadership, openness, and real policy change. You know, New Zealand has just delayed their election by a month.
Yeah, it's going to be on the same day now as the ACT election, I believe.
Yeah. So we'll see what the result of, but I'd be very surprised if the government wasn't rewarded for the leadership, not just the personal leadership, but the policy leadership they've shown in New Zealand over the past 3 years.
Well, the National Party there has made an absolute hash of it. I mean, they've cycled through three leaders in about 4 months.
Yeah.
So it's not all going well on the opposition side there. I want to come back, just ask you, before we go, ask your thoughts on Kamala Harris and just the response to her selection just off the cuff. But before I do that, Helen, just want to get one comment from you also about federalism. We've seen the creation of the National Cabinet. Somewhat hastily, I thought, even at the time, the Prime Minister decided, well, this mechanism can replace COAG. Now, believe me, I've reported on numerous COAGs and I was not sorry to see it go. But I've never been completely convinced that there is a fundamental difference between the National Cabinet and COAG, or at least that there will remain a fundamental difference between these two different organisations once we're past this crisis. And already there's been a fair bit of commentary around about the cracks showing in Commonwealth-state relations, tensions between the federal government and the Victorian government, for example. What's your view? I mean, you think about these sorts of issues. Do you share my cynicism?
Well, again, I don't think – is it cynicism or is it realism? I mean, you know, the National Cabinet could, you know, as in any time of crisis, absolutely, you know, you need an institution that can work together. But none of that can paper over the fact that there are some fundamental problems with the way in which government in Australia works.
And they've really been shown up by this, haven't they? The nursing home thing's a classic
one example. Yeah. And so, you know, it's only going to be a matter of time before, yes, those tensions reemerge and those differences reemerge, and that, you know, conversations about GST, conversations about planning, conversations about, you know, the just accountability.
Mm.
You know, all of these things are still there. It's just that in the process of dealing with the immediacy of the crisis, you know, that casts something of a sort of a protective shroud around the thing. But yeah, you know, you can't get away from the fundamental problems of the governing system.
So you think that the National Cabinet will eventually come to resemble in a lot of substantial ways anyway the mechanism it's replacing.
No, I think it's almost inevitable, and that will, you know, will then go through another process of, you know,
complaining about it.
But the key thing, I think, I mean, just a couple of points I wanted to make. I mean, you know, Megan's absolutely right. The, you know, what matters to people is competence. You know, it's you can have all the charismatic leadership and all of the, you know, the bright ideas you like in the world. But if you're not competent at delivery, if you're not competent at doing the kind of hard yards of, well, how do we take a failing system and turn it around? You know, if you don't have that sort of grit and determination and preparedness, then, you know, personal leadership will take you so far, but, you know, then it will come apart. And it's the same thing with the National Cabinet. You know, there does need to be a much stronger commitment to how do we actually get things done, and how do we take the experience that is now being shown up to us very much in you know, very clearly, how do we take that knowledge and experience and turn it into something else? And if we can't do that, and the superannuation thing is again, it's a it goes back to a point I was making earlier on. You know, that is where the government could have decided, well, our role is to think long term, yes, is to think about, yes, how we protect the public long term. And what did they do? They said, no, you as individuals, you know, you can take advantage of this.
It's
your money. And millions of people, or however many people have. I mean, I speak to lots of people every day who saw that as the lifeline. Mm. And, you know, they're not thinking about the longer term because they can't afford to. But the government could have and should have.
Yeah. And it reminds me that that's a lot of money that's been sloshing around in the economy that otherwise wouldn't have been there. So perhaps along with JobKeeper and JobSeeker and everything else, we should be recognising the sort of stimulus protection that has provided the economy, which in its own way is a kind of a depressing thought, because it suggests that perhaps we'd be in even deeper trouble than we are now. Now, we're right over time, but I just want to get your off-the-cuff responses about Kamala Harris, because it seems to me that Joe Biden's selection of her has been, I mean, the cartoon in The Australian the other day was atrocious, but the whole acceptance of her nomination has been viewed very much through the fact that she's a woman and a woman of colour. Any comments on that? Do you think it's a wise decision, or is it tokenism, as The Australian was suggesting, that it was just, you know, yet more identity politics?
I think it's a smart decision in some ways. I think it gives, Joe Biden, who is, you know, emblematic Australia, American president kind of material, it gives him a way of saying, look, I'm looking at the future, and this is what the future looks like.
Which gets a bit harder when you're 78.
It gets a bit harder when you're 78, although, you know, let's not be ageist about this, but yes. But the other side of that, of course, which has come up and I think is quite right, is again, you have to look at what she's done in the past. And she's not had a terrific record in some areas, particularly as somebody who could have made a difference in terms of the incarceration of black people and people of colour. You know, there are very legitimate criticisms being made of her that are going to come up in the campaign. So I think it's a smart move in some ways, because it does recognise what the future looks like, but it does also bring with it some difficulties that they're going to face in the next couple of months.
Listening to Helen sort of talking about, you know, I agree, I think it's a smart choice on the part of Biden, but you know, Helen, listening to you talk about her record and so on, I think that's absolutely right. I think what's fascinating about this is it became increasingly clear that Biden would need a woman, and that he would need a woman of colour. And the pool is so extraordinarily small. So I think, you know, this kind of speaks to, was it a good choice? Well, in some ways it was the only choice, given the way in which politics is playing out in the United States, that he needs to look to the future. It's in the context of Black Lives Matters. And that really raises some questions around Kamala Harris's history and background. But that extraordinarily small pool, I think, is what's fascinating about this. And of course, if we take that back into the Australian context, and we were thinking we need our next Prime Minister to be an Indigenous woman, again, we're drawing on an extraordinarily small pool. And that would be true in many countries around the world. So I think it's really speaking also to that lack of diversity in politics.
Megan?
I thought it was one of the most energising moments of the US election campaign for some time, putting aside obviously how devastating COVID has been in the US and how variable it's been. It just shows up, I think, the variability across the US. It's really incredible. It's like, you know, that we do not have that level of variability here. We certainly have it in some areas for First Nations people. I think that is one standout area that we need to immediately continue to work really hard on. I think there was actually a really big pool of women of colour that were considered for the role. And I was quite struck by that. You know, it was fairly widely canvassed, and I think there's some good reporting on the number of women of colour who were quite exceptional from right across the country with a variety of different backgrounds, as well as other women who ran in the primaries, including I followed Amy Klobuchar quite closely, and, you know, she also was, I think, a standout. Certainly for me, the and what I've read about what Biden intends to do is those women that he spoke to, a number of them, I think there were four that were close to being shortlisted for that position, will become part of the, you know, Team Biden if they are to win, or Team Biden Harris if they are to win the presidency. And I think that if Biden wins, what that administration looks like, I think, will be significantly different, certainly from what the current administration looks like. But I am more energized about what a future Biden-Harris administration could look like, and to think that that is a possibility for the US in less than 6 months' time. I think it will be fairly crushing for many people if that doesn't turn out to be the case. But so I think it's a good sign.
Well, I don't think two women in woman of one black woman in the Senate in the US is a signal of diversity.
No, let's not get carried away.
No, but the governance of the US, the governance of the US is so huge across governors and state legislatures, and he's drawn from that huge pool. And again, you tend to see a little bit more variety at the state level, and the federal level tends to take time to catch up, which I think seems to be the case here as well.
Look, we've run much longer than we should have, and I'll probably be in trouble for that. But I think if you've stuck with us and you're listening to this podcast, you'll agree it's been an absolutely fascinating discussion with three of the best. So my thanks to Helen Sullivan, Megan Fitzharris and Sharon Bessel. It's been terrific having you here. Yeah. And of course, thank you for listening to this episode of Democracy Sausage. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already, and you can comment on this podcast there as well. Until later in the week, that's your lot for now. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.